Okay. Good morning. Let me go ahead and call the Mesa City Council study session of Thursday, December 14th, 2006 to order. We have nine items on our agenda. The first one is to review the items for the December 18th regular council meeting. Let's go ahead and turn to that item in your packet. Got page one is basically reading consent and approval of minutes. Anything on page two? We have a narrative change on 3B. Is that it?
All right. Yes, Mayor, that's correct. I've distributed for you some word we got yesterday from the applicant. We've had some discussions about the proposed Ellsworth Road alignment and that curve. Some concerns that the city and the airport may be giving up some economic development potential on the airport by having that road curve too soon to the east, and so this change wording keeps that a little bit more flexible, gives us some opportunity to continue to work on that alignment in the future as actual development plans come forward.
Okay. All right. Yes, Kyle.
On page two, because of work I'm doing with some people who are involved in this, we'll need to declare a conflict on 4A, 4B, 10D, and 10D and 11D. I think that was all of them.
Okay. 4A, 4B, 10D, and 11D.
Correct.
Okay. All right, that's page two. Page three. Okay, page four. Get into contracts. EJ's Steakhouse. Page five. Additional contracts. Continued on page six. Rex.
I had a couple of questions. One was on 7H on the renewable supply for water meters. Are we at all looking at getting remote readable meters that we won't have to have people climb over back fences and get bit by dogs and all the rest someday? My dog loves to chase the meter guys.
Councilmember Griswold, we actually do use some remote reads right now. We have two primary locations. One is where we have difficult access, either due to aggressive animals or to just the containment, maybe what people have planted around meters. The second is where we have water meters in vaults. The new standards require two men, it's two-person operation, so in order to have two people read one meter, we've set those up with remotes as well. So right now, that's kind of how we've treated AMR. We're doing it where it's cost-effective, where either the access is difficult or where it would require a two-man crew to read the meter.
On newer developments, are we looking at requiring meters that we can just read over a computer line rather than driving around and spinning gas?
We have not to this point. A couple of other cities are using what they call a touch read, which basically has a little pad at the top of the vault cover of the meter box cover where you can just walk by and touch read. We're evaluating a number of alternatives right now to see what potential we may have for better technology. Got some thoughts?
I do have some thoughts. On this topic.
Thank you.
Mayor Hawker and Councilmember Griswold, I have the meter reading area that reads Dave's meters, and we are currently getting together a group to evaluate AMR.
Good.
And so we'll be working closely with Dave's group.
It's a modern, better way than driving around with gasoline, but I know there's an investment to beginning with, but over a period of years it should pay back.
And we've kind of taken the approach in everything we've done to this point that it's been cost effective to do so.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else on page six? Yes, Chris.
We would like to pull 7J. Oh. Some questions came up from the council committee. It was GDC, I believe. Yeah. There are some concerns we have about the use of the CDBG funds that we need to continue to look at. And so we'd rather just pull this off and come back maybe first meeting in January with a better option on this.
Okay. Are there time constraints on when this has to take place?
Well, there are concerns because there is lead-based paint. So we may have to do some physical barriers to keep children specifically away from those areas that may be at most risk. But we also need to make sure we have the appropriate type of funding source, or a funding source that won't create, potentially won't create any future obligations.
Right. I know that there has been some discussion about the long-term viability of that project. Is that being brought up in this context at all, or is it?
Well, the challenge, I mean, we have, I think the staff has heard from the council that we need to come back quickly with the transition plan out of the this project, Escobedo, as we know it. As you know, in the financial forecast, we've actually shown that actually phasing out of the from our subsidy. Regardless, it is lead-based paint,
right,
and requirements, so we have to be probably more expeditious in resolving that than the timeline it's going to take to actually transition residents out of there in time. But that is something we're trying to find options to and try to do it in the most economical way, recognizing that we may not be, these buildings may not be in place in the next several months.
Sure. Councilmember Reynolds.
Now that I know who I am this morning, the question that I had asked at the GDC meeting was whether or not, whether the use of the CBDG monies would commit us long-term to maintaining that facility. And so that, I think, is the specific question that.
Yeah, Mayor and Council, the way it's, the direction we're getting or the feedback we're getting isn't so much the maintenance of it necessarily, but it's the, well, it's the commitment to the long-term, I guess,
use
of the facilities after we've used those dollars. And so there's kind of like, what is the consequences if those facilities go away in the short term after having spent these dollars? And the feedback we're getting, the advice we're getting isn't real clear, and it creates a potential that there may be some, it creates some complications for our ultimate goal to transition out of the housing. So.
Okay, good. Okay, that's page 6. And we'll pull 7J then at this time. Page 7. Councilmember Summers.
Thank you, Mayor. Excuse me. On item 9F for the Power Road improvements, we're looking at utilizing some eminent domain to take the small sections of road. My question is on four of these properties, 5, 12, 16, 17, per the map, these appear to be in Gilbert. I don't think we can do that.
Mayor, Councilmember Summers. Correct. Those properties on the west side of Powell Road are in the town of Gilbert. The IGA that we have that council approved back in February allows Mesa to acquire the properties by eminent domain if necessary.
So Mesa can use eminent domain in Gilbert?
That's correct.
All right. And we
the property, the right-of-way, will be acquired in the city of Mesa because after the project is completed, the Mesa city limits will be extended to the west side of Power.
To include all
so
property.
The right-of-way that we're acquiring will be in the name of the city of Mesa.
Okay. Have we worked that through with Gilbert already?
Correct.
How that works, so they know. Okay.
Right. I think the same thing is taking place along Baseline Road, where we made the improvements to first 5 miles, and then they did the improvements on down, if I'm not mistaken. So.
Correct.
Okay. All right.
Tom. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. There on 9F, still there are two parcels of property that are being condemned because they're needed to provide room for bus shelters. And as much as I'm not a real fan of bus shelters, I'm not going to support the use of eminent domain for that. So I need to have 9F taken off the consent agenda.
Councilmember Griswold.
Just a follow-up question on that. Do we have bus service that runs down there now? I would probably agree with that. I don't know why we're taking the bus shelters right now. So that's sort of my question.
Scott?
There's bus routes down Power Road. One of the few areas in the district that actually has some buses. It's not very frequent, but there are. Okay. I don't know that I'd throw up a lot of bus shelters immediately, but there is does go down through and to the college.
Mayor, if nothing else, I think this is the good time to get the right of way. irregardless. We don't want to not get the right-of-way and then later on have to pay a lot of money and possibly see development encroaching it and costing us more money. So,
Jack, are we just getting the right-of-way? We're not building the shelters right now?
I'd have to review that with the design people, but for this particular issue, the right-of-way is most important. We can get back to you whether we're going to build the pullouts and shelters.
Kyle.
Okay, it stands right now, Gilbert's on the west, we're on the east, county owns the road. At the completion of the project, you said it will all be within Mesa City limits, so then we will own the road at that point?
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Narrow it all together.
That was my understanding. That's court,
Mayor, court, Councilmember Jones, let us get back to you on that, because I'm sure we're going to maintain power through an IGA. Whether that's going to be in the city of Mesa, we have Keith to tell us.
Mayor, through the IGA, we have an agreement. We've made an agreement all the way with Gilbert on how we're going to split Power Road up in the future, just like you alluded to with Baseline Road. Mesa is going to take Power Road basically from Baseline, which is remaining, which is in the county. This is all in the county today, all the way down to Williamsfield Road to the south side, which is the entrance to Williams Gateway. From there south, Gilbert will take Power Road all the way down to Ocotillo, and then from Ocotillo, Queen Creek's going to take Power Road from there south. So there's been an agreement made between the agencies to do that. As Craig indicated, Jack indicated, the IGA that we have with the county and Gilbert provides for Mesa to own that road. Once it's complete, we will annex it, and it'll become a Mesa road. That was an IGA, as Craig mentioned, that the council approved earlier, I think, this year. And then lastly, with the bus routes, there is Gilbert bus routes on Power Road. And so as part of this, we're providing those improvements. There's financial participation by the other partners to pay for improvements that benefit only them. That's part, again, of the IGA.
Vice Mayor.
I don't suppose as part of getting Power Road, we can get the development there at the just south of the 202 on the Gilbert side? The revenue from the Target Shopping Center there? Okay, I was just trying. Thanks, Mayor.
Sounds like you can block their entrance way, though.
Whoa!
Yeah, totally. That's a very good one.
On both 9B, 9C, there was a good neighborhood meetings held last night with Stonebridge and the neighbors on the south on the school and the traffic and where the streets go, et cetera. And I think there was a compromise reached that sort of fulfills everybody's needs. The majority of the people seem to be in favor of it. So I think it was a very good meeting. And I think a lot of people worked very hard to get a plan that was much better for their neighborhood.
Okay. All right, we're on page 8. Let's try page 9. Mike.
9G on page 8, Mayor. The recipient is Prehab of Arizona, so I'll be declaring a conflict. Okay.
Vice Mayor.
Mayor, I don't want to pull item 10C. I just want to comment that I appreciate both the developer and the neighbors working together on this. I know it was very contentious with the initial proposal, and they all went back and worked together, and it looks like there's a lot of support all the way around on this. So thank you very much, and I think the road improvements are important too. So just wanted to say thanks on that one.
Okay. Anything else on page 9? Page 10? Kyle?
There's two ordinances introduced. Which one are we pursuing? On the 10F.
Mayor, Councilmember Jones, the intent is for you to first consider the first one on the list. That's the one that the applicant is wanting to see approved, has staff support, and we believe is the best for the neighborhood or for this development. And so the idea is that you consider that one. If you approve it, then the other one goes away. If for some reason, based on the input you receive, you feel like you can't approve the first one, then the second could come up for consideration.
Okay. Are we changing any policy as far as going through P&Z and then the applicant doing modifications? How does it work, and is P&Z in concurrence with this type of an approach?
Mayor, that has been a little bit of a topic of discussion over the last couple of weeks. when the changes came up on this after the P&Z meeting and the applicant proposed the modifications, staff looked at them in light of the policy that the council had previously approved and the significance of the changes being made. We determined that it didn't quite fit the policy that council has adopted for staff to add the second ordinance to the agenda. That's why when we brought this forward a couple of weeks ago, we let council know that there was the request by the applicant for the second ordinance to be introduced. I felt like we got agreement from the council to go ahead this route so that we could have the options here. Because again, staff felt that the changes that were being made were an improvement to move the school away from Ellsworth Road, put it interior to the site, it would be a safer location. And so that's how we've moved this way. We have had some discussions with P&Z board members since we haven't had the chance to really sit down and talk with them. They've been a little confused about the process and have expressed some concerns about what's happened. We're going to visit with them next week at their study session and review the steps as it really occurred and go from there.
Okay. I would just think that it would be the other order. You would introduce the P&Z, but you could modify to that if there was concurrence. That instead of having the applicant's one comes forward, not the one that was heard at P&Z. That was my only question on it. Councilmember Griswold.
I was the one that was presented to the neighbors last night and that seemed to have the most support, and one of it was between two neighborhoods where the school goes. The little bit of room I think we have is we don't zone schools. Schools can go wherever they want. We're just dealing with the traffic aftermath once the school goes wherever it is. So that's sort of the small point there. But I agree, there should be some kind of process that if we change something after it, there's a polling process or some advisory process from P&Z I'd like to see. So I'd like to quantify that, maybe systematize that. If there's something that has, we have another one coming up too on the Levine property. If we come up with something better that suits neighbors, we have some mechanism without running it all the way back through there of getting input from the planning and zoning on there. So we can work on that. This one I'm in favor of. I think it needs to go, particularly since we don't zone schools. So
we're putting you back in the same catch 22 and we're trying to improve the process.
Right. Yeah. Mayor, if we're going to get P&Z's opinion on something, the only way they can do that is an open meeting. We can't just poll them.
Right.
And so that means delaying it, then go back to a meeting.
Yeah. Okay. Vice Mayor.
You know, we've tried this. We've tried to get something that's a one-size-fits-all, and we can't find a one-size-fits-all, which is why we tried to come up with some guidelines and then ask you to bring things outside of the guidelines back to us. But it's a real problem when what we're trying to do is we're trying to make sure that everybody gets a good opportunity for input, that if there's a better way of doing it, we don't say, oh, too late, so sorry, you know, your time for input has passed. So we can't have a better development here, something that everybody agrees to. We can't have, because the developer now has another 3 or 4 months of cost to go back through P&Z, to come back through the council, all of the processes for posting. It becomes very, very problematic. And you're right, we are, you know, facing some of those same issues when it comes to major general plan amendments, only it's even bigger because it's an entire year. So, you know, we're all trying to work to find a way that it works, but I don't think that you're going to find some template that says, this is it, and this is always going to work. So I think some measure of flexibility on our part and some measure of flexibility in the rules that allows us to end up with something better at the end of the day is a good thing.
Okay. We may want to, when we look at the general plan amendments and how we enter in and scrub down that process, maybe something will come beneficial out of the same thing with the ordinance introductions. All right, that's page 10. Page 11. Councilmember Summers.
You should just say that.
Go ahead, Scott.
John, on 10G Mountain Road, we've had this discussion many times, but for the benefit of the folks who are living in that neighborhood, Mountain Road, very small compared to the traffic, it seems, that's coming up and down. So what are the improvements going to be made by the developer for that item?
Mayor, council member, the question was, when will the road improvements be made by the developer?
When will they be made? What kind of, what are they going to do?
The developer is a part of developing that corner, and it's a kind of an L-shaped strip commercial center would be required to make those street improvements. I would have to pull the plan out, council member, and see exactly what the improvements are. I would, particularly on the arterial streets, probably two lanes in each direction, but I'd have to look at that again and see exactly how wide we were planning that for.
Okay. Well, this is an example of some of the leapfrog development that happened in Mesa years ago, even when it was in the county. And there's a significant number of folks who are living over off of Mountain Road. There are a number of businesses traveling up and down. And with the GM Proving Ground providing, it's really a barrier right now. No roads, no access. There are very few access points in and out of here. So anytime we can get some developers to improve that road in that area, I think it's going to help relieve some of the traffic congestion that occurs over on some very narrow county roads. So thank you. I'd like to see that info.
Mike.
Mayor, on 10H, page 11, I have a conflict. Alta Mesa Country Club is the applicant, and they're a customer of my business.
Okay. Rex.
That project's a very interesting one. It's reinvestment in some of our older areas that were established back in the 80s and now going back and putting new investment on top of them. I think it's a very good project for the neighborhood.
That's page 11. Page 12, subdivision plots, continues on page 13. Okay. That is the agenda for Monday night. Let's go back to the study session. Item number two is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the fire department master plan. Morning, Chief.
Morning, Mayor. Morning, Mayor, members of the council. Appreciate the opportunity to update you this morning on the fire master plan, at least the physical resource components of our master plan. Some time ago, we did this presentation before the fire committee, and they recommended that it would be good to bring it to the full study session for a presentation. As Mesa continues to grow in population, the fire EMS resources have not kept pace, and the end result is an increasing, ever-increasing response time within the city. As you know, the fire and EMS service is not a service of convenience. Inadequate response times can have a severe consequence on families and businesses. The city is on the threshold of a major crisis in its ability to maintain the fire and EMS response system, as we have known them. Chief Bradbury is responsible for managing infrastructure resources for the fire department and is here today to describe the status of these resources and the corresponding impact on our response times. So with that, I'll turn it over to Gary.
Mayor, members of the council, thanks for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. What I'd like to cover today is the fire department master plan and particularly the status of our response times and our response coverage. To begin with, I'd like to talk about our intervention and how we look at that from a fire service perspective. Specifically on intervention time, starts with the 911 call, which includes the alarm notification, dispatch, travel time, and then intervention into the emergency. That's calculated time in minutes. As we look at how it affects our fire response, we look at arriving on a fire scene within 5 to 8 minutes. It's imperative in that time to arrive on the scene and begin intervention because right at about the 8 minute mark, we go from a room and contents fire to what we term as flashover, where the full contents of the room and the structure become involved. After flashover, now we have structural component damage to the and involvement with the structure, and then that's where we have our largest fire loss. At that point of flashover is also the point in time when survival of anyone in the structure that's currently on fire is pretty unlikely. If you look at the EMS component, we look at a little bit shorter window of 4 to 6 minutes. Right at about 4 minutes, when an individual is no longer breathing from any cause, is when brain damage begins to occur. Right at about the 6 minute mark is when we have the possibility that irreversible brain damage is occurring. And it's at that point where we have limited ability to change the outcome of the patient at that point. So that 4 to 6 minutes and 5 to 8 minutes is critical in our response times. And what we shoot for in this process is a goal set by the National Fire Protection Association of 4 minute responses 90% of the time. Again, that's a goal we strive to achieve. Currently, the fire department deployment system is short by 4 fire stations. In addition to the fire stations, we're short by 5 replacement apparatus, which is based on our replacement cycle, which includes a lot of factors, but is basically based on 12 to 15 years of service per apparatus and about 150,000 miles. Also, the population served per fire station in 1980 was about 19,000 population. And in 2006, the population served has jumped up to about 26,000, which is about a 7% increase. In relation to our goal of 4 minutes 90% of the time, with the service demand today of 56,000 calls annually, we're meeting that 4 minute 90% of the time today at about 63%. This graph that we have presented here really looks at a period of time from 2003 to 2006, looks at our response times and how we've done with that. In 2003, we were averaging citywide 3 minutes 27 seconds. That figure represents, in the 4 minute 90% of the time goal, we met that 67% of the time. In 2004, we were pretty stable. In 2005, we're up to 3 minutes 39 seconds and down to meeting that 4 minute 90% of the time goal to 63%. In 2006, we're up again at 3 minutes 56 seconds on average and meeting the goal of only 61.2% of the time. What you see here in the chart represents an increase of response time of 29 seconds, or about a 14% increase in our average response times annually. What we're looking at for year-end data for 2006 going into 2007 is really an increase from the 14% to approaching 18%. The map that we're looking at now is a deployment plan as the fire department in the city of Mesa exists today with our current fire stations. And color-coded within the fire station diamonds are the response levels for all of our units within the city. You can see that in West Mesa, Engine 203 is red, and it's a unit that runs over 4,000 calls annually. What we strive for in the response process is about 2,000 to 2,500 calls annually. It gives us the opportunity for that community fire station and those fire response units to respond to emergencies within that part of the community greater than 60% of the time. And it also allows for time for community education and also fire prevention activities. If you look around the in the West Mesa, in the station around station 203, most all of the units there are in yellow. They're running 3,000 to 4,000 calls as well. So there's lots of pull from station 3 to areas that also are very busy. So it affects not only the current station 2003, but the surrounding units as well. As we get into East Mesa, you can see that our coverage gets thinner and thinner. Although the call volumes are less than in West Mesa, the completion of the 202 and the infrastructure in Williams Gateway is going to cause that population and that call volume to also increase. What we provided here was a response time map based on our current configuration for deployment. The red symbols are our current fire stations. And you can see from the color coding, the yellow areas are 0 to 3 minute response time, very close to and within a mile and a half proximity of the center of our station areas. We go to orange at 3 to 4 minutes, a dark orange at 4 to 5, and then we get into the red and the dark reds. We've got 5 to 7 or 7 plus minutes. And you can see where some of our deficiencies are in there as you look in the color coding on that map. This map represents a configuration at build-out. If we provide no more fire facilities, add no more additional units, you can see that at population build-out at about 650,000, as projected in some of the studies, that the red areas, especially in East Mesa, become greater, where we're not no longer meeting those response time averages. The map that you see posted here is a build-out map.
Chief, can I back you up one?
Sure can.
I wanted to hit on this map because Station 215 is that little one hanging off on the bottom. You have some dark red where the runways are on the airport.
Correct.
What's our FAA requirement? Are we meeting our FAA requirement for response times at the airport?
We currently meet the FAA requirement. This was brought up earlier. We didn't have an opportunity to really change the map. In the mapping system, the basically the system electronically doesn't recognize the runway as a roadway. So it does not pull that yellow 0 to 3 minute response time to the runway.
Okay.
It in fact does cover the runway.
Okay. And this is an issue with the growth of the airport as well. The FAA is going to require, as we get more and more flights in, a certain response time across the runways. So this is probably an issue we'll have to deal with in the next 5 years. Is airport response times across runways, and they're pretty strict on the number. So that's why I wanted to address that, as I had a little bit of a concern. Thank you.
Yes. Current map represents what we consider in the fire department as build out of the fire service for the city of Mesa. I see what's represented there is as many as 32 fire stations. Also represented there by color code is the blue is the existing current facilities. The yellow are current are future sites that have been purchased by the city of Mesa. And then in the gray, we have future station sites that have not been purchased. I'd like to talk a little bit about the green sites, and they are what we consider as the four fire stations that are a priority for the fire department today. Site one, which is just north and a little bit east of Station 203, is our highest priority. We've got the highest call volume issue that we're dealing with within the city there. We need to address that first. We, on site two, about the alignment of 56th and Main, we also have some high call volume issues that we're dealing with there, and also some open areas that are not covered within that 3 mile perimeter of a fire station site. We see site three at the Elliott and Signal Butte alignment as the fastest growing area of the city that's gonna create some response demands for us here in the near future. And then back to West Mesa, site four, on the alignment of Longmore and Broadway, which would be a replacement for the current Station 203, which was built in 1957. This current response time map represents what the response plan would be if we built the fire service out to build out with the 32 fire stations plotted on the map. And you can see from the other map where we had no improvements in facilities and response units that much of our red and dark red areas are gone. And we meet that 4 minute 90% of the time response time pretty effectively.
Yes, Rex.
Just wanted to clarify that statistics sometimes don't show the whole story. In the very northern part still showing red, that's Indian and state trust land with no one living on it, no roads. If you're a mountain biker and you fall down, it's going to be a little while to get help, but there's not really people living in there. So I don't think you're ever going to build a station, and if you get injured out in the desert, you're going to wait a while. So it's sort of statistics don't quite show what's going on there.
Right. Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Griswold, that is correct. Let me go to the next slide, and we'll talk about that just a little bit more. This slide represents our response volume load. And you can see where we're yellow, we're pretty light. And if you look up in the far north sections of Mesa where that red area was, you can see that those call volumes are also very light up there. You can see in our far northern plat there, we actually for 2005 had one call for emergency service. So the volume is there. Like any other process that we go through, the fringes are always hard to totally protect. What also this map represents is the center corridor of the city of Mesa. We call it the Broadway corridor, where our highest call volumes are from West Mesa. That continues to increase going east. And we can feel that that trend will continue on into the future. This map represents our current response patterns as developed through our CAD system, which is computer-aided dispatch, and also our AVL system, which is automatic vehicle location. Computer-generated response patterns are really where we can meet our four-minute response times 90% of the time. You can see that we've got pretty good coverage in a lot of areas, but you can also see that a lot of the areas of the city are not covered by those response patterns. The four fire stations that we are proposing that we are behind today are indicated in red on this current map. The two areas over there in West Mesa, surrounding Station 3, the 56th and Main, and then also the Elliott and Signal Butte station. And that's a fairly good representation of the response coverage plan that we would get out of those facilities.
Got another question for you.
Chief, more of a statement. I was looking at page 11, back you up slightly. And you really, for folks who are viewing this outside, you can't see the blue lines very well, but they're where the county islands are. Seems like we're receiving quite a few calls for service in the county. We don't serve the county, right? Who does?
We do.
Rural Metro, right?
So Rural Metro serves much of that area, and there are times when Rural Metro will call for assistance. Mm-hmm. And depending on the emergency, we may respond into those areas.
Okay, so we won't always respond to a call for service in there. Do we receive reimbursement back from Rural Metro?
No, but we have looked into that. And when you look at the number of incidents where we actually deploy some resources for any period of time, it's so infrequent that what we discovered was it probably cost us as much to generate the billing and than it would be just to go on the calls. We're monitoring that very closely, though.
Right. It'd be interesting to pursue that, but also the fact is that our response times in our city for our citizens who are paying for the service are affected by being drawn out outside of our boundaries.
Councilmember Summers, that's accurate, and it's a very difficult decision to make when somebody's calling for assistance and the situation is dire. We will try to err on the side of public safety, understanding that it does deplete some of the resources in that area for the citizens of Mesa. We also understand that many of our incidents are on the roadways, and those are our citizens crossing through those county islands, and so we feel it's pretty important to be very careful about when we deny service upon that request.
All right. No, it's certainly a difficult problem, and it's something that the county and some other cities are dealing with, and I suspect we'll have to deal with it in the near future. Thank you.
If I was looking at the map on page 10, I would say that Ellsworth and Warner would be probably a future site, but currently have you overlaid the build-out master plan for units that will be projected? Have you done anything beyond 2025? Or is this data just to 2025?
Mayor Hawker, no, we have not. We took some of the basic information that we could get for build out to 2025 and plugged it into the maps. We have not gone further than that.
Okay, because I don't think build out will occur in 2025. Okay, and that then leads into some of that's pretty well undeveloped land right now, the whole GM proving ground area. Are we working with the impact fees? And knowing what the demand needs, you indicated there are four stations behind. I'm not sure whether that's a new phenomenon, or whether we've always been four behind, or we're always playing catch up, but if we know that that's the case, then it kind of indicates to me that something's wrong with what we're doing is setting aside the capital to build the infrastructure and that seems to be new growth pays for itself, which is an impact fee. Is that being incorporated into our revised studies to get those rates up if that's what we need to do?
Mayor, I believe that the city staff is looking into that. However, I believe the way we're currently structured is the impact fees actually pay off debt. And it's not essentially going to an account to actually build fire stations and buy property. I'll let Brian follow up on that.
Thanks, Chief Beck. Mayor Hawker, Chief Beck is correct in that we use it to pay bond debt, but we pay bond debt on new stations that are developed. Our issue has always been is we have those new stations that have come online, stations 216, 217, 215 recently that we're still paying debt on. But our issue has always been, or at least it is recently, is while we can focus impact fees either toward debt service or toward straight new construction, we do not have the operational cost to fund the staffing in our forecast models. That would require, I think it's 13 new positions for each station at well over $1 million, $1.5 million per station. So while, again, our capital costs are available through one means or another, the operational cost is where we run into our difficulty.
But we could at least, you've identified sites. The sites could be identified and purchased.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. And we build those into our impact fee numbers and projections and utilize those resources of the sites we bought in order to set the rates for future site acquisitions and things of that nature.
And Mayor, I think that's indicated by the slide 9 where it says
future.
Those are not locations
that we currently control?
No, which ones are the ones we have sites that we've purchased, right, but we haven't built on?
The current sites that we own that have no fire stations on them are the sites that are in yellow.
Okay, sorry. So the yellow. So I think the city's actually done a very good job trying to anticipate that purchasing the land. What's interesting, though, Mayor, to your point about new growth, is when you look at the map, demand for two of the four new stations that were behind are actually on the far, about as far west as you can get on the city limits. So either there's been a change in density or there's been a change in demographics or the demand for these services, which has created that need. So it's not, I mean, you're right, looking out into the future, it certainly is, we need to be very cognizant. I think when we bring the impact fees, we need to talk about, especially some of those areas around the GM Proving Grounds, about that demand that's going to be out there for new growth and how that will support new stations. But again, and Brian said it, we, even with the four stations, right now we will be graduating our class this Friday?
Yes.
Tomorrow?
Yes.
That will be able to help, will be available to pick up, will really be available to support one of the four sites. What we don't have is a home for them. So they're going to be cohabitating, I'm not sure what the right word is, company.
Oh, that's so wrong.
Isn't that what you guys do?
No.
They're going to be living together with the company of Station 3 in a very, very small station. Probably one of our, I don't know if it's our smallest, but it was very small. At least when I was in there, my elbows kept hitting the walls. But
it's 50 years old.
Yeah, so we're actually going to be double company in that one small facility. And so in that case, we have the personnel, but not the facility. Beyond that, we have, you know, land out in the, throughout the rest of the city, but then we don't have, and we could probably go get, you know, we need new capital dollars, but the biggest concern is, Brian just said it, the operations, the personnel cost to fund that on an ongoing basis is really the big challenge we have going forward.
And I think the slides and the playing catch-up is something I've been familiar with since I came on council. So it's, although it's interesting to see, it's not necessarily new. It seems like that's been the process. But we're also, with this council, have said that public safety is our top priority. Fire and police are where we want to put the money, and I think that's what the citizens have indicated too. So what I'm trying to figure out is, in our financial scheme, if we are in fact going down, is it because of sales tax slippage? Is it not as much going into public safety? Is the percentage going someplace else? I'm trying to identify the root cause of what's happening, if there's a trend line shown, and how can we stop that from happening? And I'm not sure I've identified quite what that is. Brian?
I would say, Mayor, that one of the things is that we have not seen less money going into public safety by percentage. I think as we talked to you in our forecast in October, the majority of the new sales tax dollars that we received, the two-tenths this year, about 96% of the, no, a significant amount of that.
Remember the stat you had yesterday? Yet last year, when we made all the cuts in the budget, public safety still went up by 27%, I think, or something like that. I think that number is right. It went up. It was the only category that actually increased. So there has been that commitment. It's certainly reflected. But it's keeping up, I think. There's more demands out there and accelerating in the different categories. I think more than just, I don't think it's just about growth anymore.
Well, and I'm trying to figure out if the way the city used to be financed before the other communities took off with regional malls, is it a sales tax slippage? Is that the majority of why we're not sustainable in Mesa to the same level? Or what's, have we identified it?
Well, I think in basic sense, Mayor, going back to our discussions with the Future Financing Committee, when we looked at sales tax when controlled for inflation or retail sales when controlled for inflation, over time we have seen a slippage in that. We also have seen a slippage in per capita consumption of utilities in a great extent because of water conservation methods, electric conservation, gas conservation, all those conservation methods. So our revenues per capita generation is lower than what it used to be. And then you can factor in inflation, things of that nature. The chief also points out that more and more, I haven't looked specifically at their numbers, but things become weighted towards salaries. And we become the salary adjustments made citywide and the salary growth continues to eat up a lot of our resources. It's part of a service industry that we must realize that that's where a lot of our resources go. But yes, over time, I think those per unit revenue costs or per unit or per resident revenues have declined over time.
Is it a trend that we just need to accept, or is there a corrective action that can be taken?
Mayor, I think that's the question the community and the council, we all have to ask together, because if we want to maintain ourselves, if we maintain ourselves at the lowest per capita cost city in the valley, there's no doubt that at some point we will be, our services will have to be adjusted to reflect that same per capita cost. I mean, we will continue to squeeze and push ourselves to use every dollar most efficiently, but at some point, the 4-minute response time to 90% of the time may not be able, a standard that we will be able to maintain throughout the city, and so that will be a challenge. It's either that or it's a matter of choices. What other opportunity, you know, what other things that we're doing that we won't do in exchange for this?
And the other question I have to put it in perspective is, you mentioned the 4-minute response time, 90%. What are the surrounding communities? That's your target standard, but maybe we're not any different than all the surrounding. Is Gilbert, Chandler, Phoenix, are they comparable to what we're doing, or are they meeting the 4-minute response time?
Mayor Hawker, members of council, I don't have that data in front of me. Valley-wide, we all strive to meet the same standard. I can't tell you what the other cities are exactly by percentage. I can tell you that probably most, if not all, cities do not meet fully the 4-minute 90% of the time, but we could get that information back to you.
Okay, because I'd like to know whether we're doing better because we are concentrating on those services or not than our comparable cities, just because you have that target.
Right.
It's nice, and I kind of agree with you from the, you know, that'd be a goal, but you know, if we're the only one out of 23 that are targeting that and everyone else is below us anyway, then maybe we're not hurting as much as some of the rest would, I mean,
Mayor,
the report would indicate.
It's difficult at this point to determine because cities calculate their response times with different data. We're in the process regionally of hammering that out to come to some agreeable way of reporting response times. But I think what is clear is that in the last 3 years, with the exception of the staffing for 2018, we have not added any staff. And the population has continued to grow at about a 3% clip. So what we see is that as time goes on, we are absolutely outstripping our ability to just to maintain what we've always known in the city of Mesa. Now, we can say that's maybe a little better or maybe a little worse, But I think the question is, do we want to maintain the level of service that we've grown accustomed to, and what is that worth? How do we do that? I can tell you that we are currently out of bond authorization for fire facilities, and there apparently there, at this point there is no plan to provide for that. We are really at a point of no return with regard to this issue. If yes, we were behind, and we have always been behind, and we will probably, as Mr. Brady has said, never meet 100% of that goal. What we do know is that if we don't begin to take action quickly, that we will never get close to what we are today. That is slipping at an, our response times are slipping at an alarming rate. Just over the last 3 years, I believe it's an indication of just pure saturation of the system. There is simply no slack left in the system to pick up additional demand. And what we're getting to see is response times citywide slip significantly, and that will continue until we begin to add additional resources. Okay.
But looking at it from a citizen standpoint, if I believe that public safety is where the government should be spending its money, that's why I'm staying in Mesa and like it, but I know that the data from the other cities is comparable or better. That's what I want to know. I want to know what our comparative cities are, because if you're moving and picking a site location for a home, you check out the schools, you check out the public safety. So I really need that comparison off from some of our
very reasonable requests, and we'll get that data to you as soon as we can.
Thank you. Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. I think it's important to highlight the fact that we have not been cutting the funds to fire. That point that you were making, Brian, is a very important point, and that is that these are costs that keep going up on a per firefighter basis, based on things like benefit costs going up, PSPRS contributions going up significantly. The fire, you know, that the way that works is that they're capped and the city picks up the difference. So we have some significant cost adjustments that are occurring there that impact our ability to hire more people. And it isn't a matter of this council not prioritizing dollars for it. It's that we don't get as much for the same dollars as we used to get. And it doesn't match with inflation. So I don't want to have this misperception out there in the community, because I've had people contact me and say, well, I thought you said this was your priority. It is. It's just that making it a priority means even more and more and more dollars. And so we're trying to control the things that we can control, but there are things that are outside of our control. So that's a challenge. Also, the Urban Land Institute folks said something interesting, and they said there is no such thing as build out. And I think that the west side of Mesa really proves that. The density issues that we're dealing with. And so for me, and this isn't just because I happen to represent the west side of Mesa, because a whole lot of this is Tom's district, not my district, so I'm not, you know, this isn't a district issue. Relieving Fire Station 203 is one of the most important things that we can do. So my question is, given the fact that we're out of bonding money, we aren't out of, at least my understanding is, we're not out of impact fee money. Can we purchase the land site that we have identified? Can we find some way of purchasing that site at Alma School and 8th Street, which is just so critical because it's been so hard to find a site, so hard to find a location. I don't want that to get slowed down in the process. And when you look at where we're getting more and more calls for service, it's over on that west end. So were you going to get to that if
yes,
you kept turning the pages?
Yeah, we hadn't finished the mayor with
your Sorry. Sorry about that.
All right, why don't we do a couple more questions and we'll let you wrap it up, Rex, and then Tom.
Well, since 1941, when our city fathers decided we'd finance our entire system on sales tax revenue and utility profits, why are we teaching people to conserve water? Shouldn't we be teaching them to use all the water they can and run this up to provide for police and fire? Because 60% of our budget right now, our general fund budget, is going for police and fire and courts. Yeah. So I think we got to do away with conserving water. You know,
Tom?
I'm not sure I want to follow that. I'd like to try to get a little bit more historical perspective on this. The mayor says that since he's been on the council, this has been an issue, and I know it was sometime after 1941, but I'm not exactly sure when you first got on the council. So, I mean, are we talking about from the 80s? We've known that we're behind on our fire stations and we're just continually playing catch up, or has it just been since the 90s or the mid 90s, or do we have a way of identifying how we felt in 1985, 1990, 1995? Do we have studies that say this is, I mean, did anybody come to the council in 1985 and say, you know, we're two fire stations behind or three fire stations behind?
Mayor Hawker, Council Member Rawls, I've been with the city and with this department since 1980.
Okay.
We've been in a tremendous growth rate citywide since what, the mid-70s through today. My perspective from historically from being a part of this organization is that, yes, we've always been behind. The leadership of the fire department, I can recall, has been to this council many, many times, and positively, and that's how we've got to the point where we are today with 17 fire stations. That simply has not stopped.
Okay.
We're still growing. We've got some population demographics issues in West Mesa that need to be addressed. The fire department really has been looking forward to build out in East Mesa for many, many years. Now all of a sudden we're having to take a step back and look back to West Mesa. We've got to settle the issues with West Mesa so we can move back towards East Mesa and continue with that build out within the city limits. And again, as it was stated earlier, build out is a kind of a perception and not really a finality.
And just to continue along this line, the decision to build a fire station and to fund the staff, et cetera, aren't things that you turn around in you know, 20 minutes at a study session. They're long-term processes, and choices were made, decisions were made, priorities were set on how to spend money in the past that have gotten us to where we are today. That'd be fair, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I mean, you know, if the decision had been made to spend $50 million on fire stations out of the quality of life money rather than $90 million for the Arts Center, we'd have our three. I'm not saying that's a bad decision. I'm not trying to revisit it. I'm just saying decisions were made as to how to use resources on prior occasions. And we're now facing what the chief described as a crisis, as a, not, it wasn't a break-even point. What was the phrase you were using?
It's really a point of no return.
Point of no return. And so we're now having to play catch-up. We've played catch-up for 20-plus years, but it appears to be, at least I haven't sat through any of these other meetings, that the degree of the concern is higher today than you've remembered in the past. Is that fair?
I think that's a fair statement.
Councilmember Rawls, clearly as a city grows, you're never able to keep up absolutely. So what you see is response times fluctuate by a couple of seconds here and there, provided the community is keeping up with the growth rate in a responsive kind of way. What we have seen really in these last 3 years is a very significant deterioration in the response time. And when we look into the future and we look at additional resources that we need to at least stabilize that situation, we don't see them for at least 3-4 years out. And that's if we took action today. It takes 2 years to build a fire station, including training the staff, purchasing the apparatus, putting it through plans review, and all the things that are necessary there. So if you look at the process to acquire the type of capital necessary to build a fire station, you can add a significant, more appear undetermined, but significant amount of time to that formula. So that's pretty much the message here today, is that we have the service in the past has been very, I believe, acceptable. And in fact, I would commend the workforce for doing an amazing job of keeping up with the growth with a pretty much a flat staffing level for the last 5 years at least. But we've simply reached a point of no return in that. If we don't take action soon, we will continue to slide, and we will never even get to the 63% that we showed you here today.
Right. Just one other question, though, or maybe it's more of a comment, is that the slide that you're talking about that started 3 years ago was caused by the decisions that were made and the priorities that were set more than 3 years ago. Right? I mean, you're shaking your head, but the audience can't see that.
Yeah. Councilmember Rawls, I was not here at that time, but clearly the City Council has a very complex job and attempts to satisfy the needs of the community. I'm really not in a position to
to judge that.
Chief, I apologize. I didn't mean to put you in a position where you were trying to criticize prior councils. I'm just trying to put this in a historical perspective that these things have long lead times, and if we've started to see a deterioration over the last 3 years, it's because of prior decisions that were made before that, because you can't turn the ship around in the middle of the ocean immediately. So that's all I'm saying is choices were made, priorities were set, that we wouldn't build an extra fire station, we would do something else, good or bad. That's my only point. And I don't know where I want to go with it, except I think when we start talking about how we fix it, we have to understand that there might be a need to change some of those priorities.
Rex.
As chairman of the fire committee, there's also a new paradigm 3 years ago happened. We became the primary doctor for a good part of our population. 80% plus of our calls are medical. They're not fire. If 20 years ago, when you were hired as a fireman, they said you had to be a paramedic, you would have laughed. Now we don't hire, except you have to be a junior doctor to be a fireman. And that's changing. People don't have doctors. They're calling us for an amazing array of things that we never saw before because the medical system is imploding. So that's adding to whatever decision you're making. That's, I think, is causing a lot of the acceleration of the problem on the medical coming. So things are changing rapidly. I don't know how we get out of the medical business as fire people. I'm looking at triage. I'm looking at what don't you answer and calls. It's hard to say. But we're showing up at a lot of calls that I don't know if we need to. But I don't know how to get out of the business and say, no, we're not going to serve you. We are going to serve you. And that's what we're getting into.
Okay. Why don't we try to finish the presentation, and we'll write down questions. I think we still have several more to answer. So what page are you on?
Let's begin on page 14.
All right.
And we'll get into the question that's on the table that was coming up about future Fire Station 218. We have a future Fire Station 218. It's the number one priority that we saw in green on one of the previous maps. And currently we have the staffing and the apparatus for that emergency response crew. It's currently funded through Quality of Life. Personnel for 218 will graduate on the 15th, which is Friday, and they will go into service. We are going to put that company in service at Old Station 203, which was built in 1957. It is by far the smallest fire station we have, and with the support of our staff out there, they are going to make it work for the time being. It is not an ideal situation by any means. Property acquisition funding. We currently have cash available from pre-sold fire bonds, so the dollars are there to purchase the property. The location that we're looking at today is A Street and Alma School. It's just north and east of the intersection, north of the Circle K store. We have a willing seller. The appraisal and selling price is together at $915,000. And we also have a partnership developing with the Mesa Grande Neighborhood Association that really wants to partner with us in designing and developing that site for a fire station. The aerial that you see before you right now represents the property. It's at the north part of the page. You can see three large parcels there that are vacant except for one home structure that's been there for quite a number of years. It's 2.7 some acres. There's plenty of property there to build a facility. City Engineering has evaluated the site and has approved the purchase for the building of the property.
There's no Circle K in the corner.
And then from there, we'll open it up to any questions you might have.
You know, Mayor, if I may, just before we go to more questions, many times the question is asked, are there ways that we can improve what we do or reduce some things that may be a lower priority within the department? And we probably will give you reports on that as time goes forward, but we've completed a pilot and we're in the process of a second pilot where we've discontinued all of our fire company activity in a public education and community involvement areas for the next 60 days so that we can evaluate whether or not those activities have somehow had a negative impact on our response times. So we're taking some fairly serious steps to to try to figure out if there are any way, if there is any way, that we can trim just a few seconds off that response time, and we'll be reporting those back to you as the results come available.
What percentage of your workforce takes care of fire prevention, education, enough to man another station, or just a couple of individuals? I was trying to figure out the magnitude of what you might be expecting from that change. And I guess the biggest question, I'm sure that's unanswerable, is whether it's a short time, and then by not having the education, you actually have to do more responses at some future date, which is why you're trying to be preventive. But from the first question, just how many people are active in those type of activities?
Chief Puckett says we currently have 8 inspectors in that process. In the public education area.
Right. And the typical manning of a station would be how many people?
Well, it's 4 person per shift, but so it's 13 essentially, 1 for vacation and leave offset.
Right. Okay, thanks. All right, other questions? Kyle.
Okay, you have a class graduating tomorrow, but how are we going to be impacted now with those who are in the drop? Are we going to be able to keep up? Say this is a company that's available for an apparatus that's going to be sharing a facility in the interim, but with the drop coming, how are we projected to keep up with the number of individuals to fill those slots?
Yeah. The city has, we've worked very closely with HR on a plan for succession planning. There will be another recruit class beginning, I believe, about March. Should have between 15 and 20 recruits in that group. We're currently testing for that as we speak. And those positions will all be for attrition, to replace the people who have retired through drop, as well as in our initial plan was to try to pre-hire 3 to 4 to offset the overtime that would be incurred through the transition. What we're finding is that even with those additional positions, they're actually leaving at a rate faster than we had predicted. So it's kind of gobbling that up as we go, but that's pretty much the answer to your question. Need to add anything, Gary?
No.
Okay.
Cover it well.
It's just going to be a challenge to keep those slots filled now.
Absolutely.
Okay. Scott.
I think you should have added one more slide, which was the picture station 203. I don't think people fully appreciate what trying to jam 4 more people into station 203 means. That's one heck of a shoehorn you guys have, because that I don't even think the truck will fit. I don't know how you're going to grease the sides of the because wow, that's something. I don't know if this prior councils have approached this. Is not this might be a policy we might want to pursue, and it won't fix all the problems, just a couple of them. There are a few stations going to be built on or around the GM proving grounds here in the near future. Looking at this map and considering the development out there, those stations will be almost exclusively for new residents and new businesses that move into that area. Some other communities, and correct me if I'm wrong, have negotiated with the owners of very large developments like we might see here for the donation of the land, the construction of a site, the purchase of apparatus, and in some instances in the state, even staffing the truck for a year or two. We may want to consider, I'm not suggesting that far, but we may want to consider as a policy for some of these fire stations in Southwest Mesa entering into some negotiation with large developers, not the small ones, but the large ones, because those costs for operating and capital improvement will actually be passed on to folks who live in this area, do business in this area, and really what it is it's the growth paying for itself quite literally. That's just a comment.
Mayor, if I could, to Councilmember Summers, we have had instances in the past where folks have donated or developers have donated parkland and things of that nature, and we would encourage and work with that. What we then do is give them an offset to their impact fees, associated impact fees. So if there's typically a station donation or the land, the facility, the apparatus, we would offset that impact fee. Just I also wanted to note, and Chief Beck and Chief Bradbury noted it, but on 218, just so we know, we have the cash to acquire the property. That doesn't build the building. We do not have bond authorization to build, construct the facility. We will get some revenues back from the sale of a site at Adobe and Wrecker that we will put toward, that has to go back to fire bonds, but we do not have the money in our fire bonds to build Station 218. We will have to come through that either with additional bond authorization, look at future quality of life if those funds potentially grow to enough. Again, we watch those fairly closely. We have funded, as the chief said, the last three stations with quality of life funds, 216, 217, and now the folks for 218, as well as two adaptive response units prior to that. So we've spent a considerable amount of money. I'm going to estimate somewhere over $35 million in the past 9 years towards station staffing, but really that's been their only growth in the past 9 years has been from quality of life.
Okay. Mike. Reference to Scott's point, would not a community facilities district work in that area to build fire stations or add infrastructure?
Mayor and Councilman Whalen, that's in the preliminary conversations we've had with some of the large developers around the GM properties. We've had that discussion. First of all, the assumption that whether the council is even interested in a CFD was our first question, but if that were considered, I did ask that they may need to consider that as an option. Now, my understanding, what I've been told that state law does not allow for, though, is for operational dollars to be used. But it's certainly the land and the construction of the facility would be an eligible use of the CFD assessment.
And then, Chief, any possibility? I know 10 years ago, before we built the station way down in the southeast portion of the community, we put a temporary facility in with modular and a canopy. Is that something that we possibly could do on this site to alleviate the fact that we don't have the money to build it yet?
Councilmember Whalen, yes, we are in the process of evaluating that as an alternative. There is a structure on the location that people live in. It may accommodate firefighters. We would need, though, to design and construct some secure quarters for the apparatus there.
Right.
So again, it's something that we could pursue in the interim, because as I said, even if a council was in a position to take action today, it would still be quite a bit of time before we would see anything substantial. So we are in a position of looking at all the alternatives.
Or are there any other potential industrial sites that would have sufficient buildings that could house a temporary facility somewhere in that area?
We would love to find a vacant occupancy in a strip shopping mall somewhere that we could remodel and put something on the side, a lean-to on the side for the truck. We're thinking about calling Sheriff Joe, see if he had any tents available. We're gonna make it work with the people that we have.
Okay, thanks.
Vice Mayor.
Brian, I have a follow-up question for you. You said that when the sale of the property happens at Wrecker and Adobe, that those need to go back to fire bonds. Do they have to go back to bonds, or could they go to fire construction?
We could use it for fire construction. We typically, that type of bond project. But since that land was purchased with bond proceeds and those have yet to be fully paid off, we would have to bring them back to the bonds, but it basically builds our pot of money for which to use those type of things for.
But sometimes if you can just do something in cash instead of bonding
right.
it, that's...
And we wouldn't bond it. We would use the cash
that's
back from the sale
to
do that. I'm sorry, to offset.
Okay. But we weren't going to take, what I'm saying is instead of taking the cash,
right.
paying down the bonds, we use the cash
oh,
for the
right.
construction.
Right.
That's what
right.
I was going at there. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that, and I think that actually in terms of design, the quality of life tax was a well-designed tax, because what it did was it said this much for capital, and then the capital, the tax for the capital goes away. And then what we recognized was that if you built things, that there were operational costs attached. And frankly, I think Keno has been the biggest proponent for always talking about, if you build something, can you afford to operate it? Which is, if I were going to say something that I think perhaps didn't get done as well years ago, it's this notion of what does it, what's the life cycle cost of something as opposed to just the construction cost. So if we'd look at, say, a library, we'd say, can we afford to build the library? Yeah, we've got the money to build the library. Now the next question is, can you put the books in? Can you put the staff in? Can you operate that for 25 years? And I think that this council has been really good at looking at that, not just constructing and not having the money that went along with it. But if you look at quality of life, my recollection is, and maybe this has changed, Brian, that's why I brought you up, that the thing that has shifted since that was passed by the voters in 1998 is that there is more money going to public safety than was originally planned when that came about. That there's been some of a shift underneath that and more of a shift towards public safety. Is that still true?
Mayor Hawker, Vice Mayor Walters, that's correct. Not only in the fire department, they have an allocation of capital dollars that has increased a couple million, I believe. The police capital dollar allocation has increased. The fire department has staffing for the three stations as well as two of the adaptive response units. I think that's 63 personnel. Those salaries have increased slightly higher than what we'd anticipated 10 years ago. So there's more money going there. But you hit the nail on the head in that we do have the 0.25% of the quality of life remaining that funds those 63 firefighters as well as our 120 police officers into the future. Our problem is we don't get to add any more. We're at the end of that program on growing that.
And I think it's great for us to have this conversation, and I appreciate it. So what I'm about to say next is not criticizing that. But if we had the police department up here, they would be showing us the areas where they're falling behind and where, you know, they'd like to see us put in more more capital or more and more manpower. It's a struggle that a growing city has that I think that this is just indicative of what's happening in this part of the country with so much growth. And so my experience on this council is that we are always playing catch up. The difference today for me is that it's a little more catch up than we were at. My final question has to do with how much of our response time, you know, and the increase in that response time is tied to two factors. One being the growth in Southeast Mesa, where the fire stations are farther away from the people. How much is that adding to that response time? And the second one being Station 203 and how many calls are pulling people off of other places. So if we can address these two issues that seem to me to really, I would think, be driving response times in a huge way, would that do a lot to bring us back to where we need to be?
Mayor Hawker, Council Member Walters, I think you really have a good perception of that. It's both issues that are driving the response times up. It's not the issues of the stations where we're running 2,000 to 2,500 calls where we're pretty stable. It's the far west Mesa with population density increases and changes in the community. And it's also far southeast Mesa where development is occurring at a rapid rate and we don't have the facilities down there. We have occasionally quite lengthy response times down south of the Gateway area. And every time you have those, the percentage on average goes up.
Okay. Vice Mayor Walters, if I may, we will try to extract the data to answer your question specifically. We don't have that available right now.
All right. Well, thanks for the update here this morning.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the information.
Mayor, if just as an update, what we'd like to do, you probably maybe need to ask the question specifically or give council a heads up. What we would like to do is, it wasn't on the draft agenda today, but we would like to move forward with the purchase of the property that was identified at 8th Street Downville School, and we'd like to go ahead and place that on the agenda for Monday to go ahead and begin taking action on that. If that's making sure that council doesn't have a problem with that, we'll do that.
I think there's concurrence with
sure.
that action.
Okay, good.
Thank you. Right. Thank you.
All right. Item number three is here a presentation on the Motorola 800 megahertz system.
Good morning, Mayor Hawker, council members.
Seated here today with me is Chief Information Officer Karen Kelly, Communications Director Mike Brown, and Assistant Fire Chief Gary Bradbury, and I'm Greg Fowler, the Assistant Police Chief. This morning our purpose is to talk about the 800 megahertz radio system, which the City of Mesa is partners with the City of Phoenix, and several other partners that are coming online with us. And also to talk about an upgrade that we need to do to keep the system in the best form that it possibly can be. The 800 megahertz radio system is formerly known as the Perwin Topaz. That stands for the Phoenix Regional Wireless Network. Mesa's portion is known as Topaz, the Trunked Open Arizona Network. It is a valley-wide two-way radio communication system. At present, there are over 20 agencies participating. Example of those agencies here in the East Valley is we dispatch for Gilbert Fire Department. They operate on our system, Gilbert PD, AJ Fire District. AJ Municipal Services are also coming onto the system. Those agencies pay a fee at this time, and we operate with them under an IGA system. Currently, the 800 megahertz system is an extremely healthy system. We have over 16,000 portable radios or subscriber units operating successfully on the system. We have achieved regional interoperability, and the key component of Arizona's first responder system is our ability to communicate, and this system does allow us to do that. Example of how healthy the system is, in 2005, we documented over 40 million radio transmissions. A brief historical timeline for the 800 megahertz radio system. In July of 1998, we issued an RFP jointly with Phoenix. Motorola was awarded a contract in May of 2000 to build and install this system. In June of 2003, the system went live. We finished our functional acceptance tests, and the very first agency to go on was the Apache Junction Fire District. In September of 2003, the police departments in Mesa and Gilbert went live. And in May of 2005, the fire department here in Mesa went live on 800 megahertz. In December of 2005, we completed final acceptance testing, and the system has been working as designed very well for us and Phoenix. One thing I'd like to talk about with regard to how well the system works, you may have heard some information recently that we had an issue during the serial shooter cases that we didn't have complete interoperability with Phoenix. I was part of that operation where we ran a task force here in Mesa. As you know, the shooters were residing here. We brought over a very large contingent of officers, detectives, SWAT team members, anybody that we could use to do surveillances to be part of this operation. And the key figure was, in our communications, we wanted to have encryption. We didn't know about how sophisticated the level was of our suspects at the time, because we weren't even sure who we were looking for when we first started. So we wanted to make sure we were encrypted so that in case they had scanning capabilities, they couldn't hear us. The 800 megahertz system is a computerized radio system. It's a high level of technology, and when you maintain encryption keys, you have to change those periodically to protect the integrity of the system. We had experienced an encryption key change between Phoenix and Mesa, and we hadn't synced them up that night that we were working. The following night, when we actually made the arrest, we had corrected that. So the system is working as designed. We're very happy with it. We get better coverage out of that system today than we ever did out of our old legacy radio systems. So the system is healthy. We appreciate its functionality, and our partners appreciate it. We have no issues of major concern where it doesn't work. It provides us excellent coverage. However, it is a computerized radio system. And just like the computers you buy at home, you buy them and 2 years later the technology changes. Today we're here to also talk about a 7X upgrade. And 7X is the name of the operating platform which Motorola has provided new technology for us. Currently the system operates or resides on what they call the 6X platform, and that technology has changed. So with such a dramatic change, it's no longer just a issuance of a new software upgrade, it's now a platform change. So they've gone to what they call 7X. 7X will give us the capability to greatly expand the amount of radio traffic we have on our existing frequencies. It will allow us to grow the system and maintain our capacities. It gives us the ability to incorporate future enhancements to the technology, and it also provides for long-term interoperability with our partners. The total cost of the 7X upgrade system, as negotiated by the Perwin Topaz Group, is just over $7.5 million. As you can see in the slide, there are cost-sharing benefits. Phoenix will pay $5.5 million. Tempe, who is about to come onto the system, will be a little over $600,000, and the other numbers reflect what the other partners would pay. You see our figure down at the bottom has come down to just under $1.5 million. What we've identified for the funding source for the 7X upgrade, the City of Mesa was awarded a grant from the Federal Homeland Security UASI program, that's the Urban Area Security Initiative, of $540,000. Those funds can be used for interoperability for a project just such as this. We've also identified $450,000 in lease savings money. That was money that we had intended to buy additional subscriber units. However, we have not seen the need to buy those at this time, so we could appropriate those funds towards this purchase. And then our request for you today is to authorize the city manager to enter into an agreement to have Phoenix purchase the upgrade from Motorola, which would incorporate Mesa as well. And then we would need to identify an additional $465,000 to make that work. This money would have to be paid in the fiscal year 08. So what we're asking today is your approval for the 7X upgrade and the authorization to spend the additional funds beyond what I identified in FY 08.
Okay, questions? Scott?
Chief, just not to mince words or anything, one of the things that you had just said was that the UASI grant, one of the things that can be used for is interoperability. Actually, interoperability is a major focus of federal efforts and grant money since 9/11 for emergency responders, both federal, state, tribal, and local. So this is a this type of system, maybe not necessarily 800, but interoperability is a major focus of this grant effort.
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Summers, that's correct. We had originally looked at this money possibly for target hardening purposes here in Mesa, but when you look at the events that occurred in our country after 9/11, one of the criticisms was that the police and fire departments did not communicate well and didn't have systems that communicated well. The beauty of this system, the Perwin Topaz system here in our valley, is we work very well together. We have a partnership that's strong. This is a joint upgrade. It's not just one agency trying to perform this. It's all the partners recognizing this is a needed upgrade, and all the partners going to their funding sources, their councils, their governments, and saying we need to perform this upgrade in order to maintain our capability to communicate in the event of a catastrophic event valley-wide.
And not just that, but on a day-to-day basis, I think a lot of people would be surprised that the police department and the fire department oftentimes have trouble communicating. On the typical incident, a vehicle accident's a good example where the fire department and the police department both will respond, as well as Southwest Ambulance. And oftentimes there's some communication problems there as well. 9/11 is the example of communication failure, particularly in New York, where the systems didn't work. There was trouble with police agencies. There are multiple police agencies there who couldn't talk to one another. The fire agencies couldn't talk to the police department, and a lot of discussion has gone into the 343 firefighters, not to mention the police officers, but I know that number very well. The 343 firefighters, how many of those folks we might have been able to get out of that building if we could have communicated with them? And part of that issue was the police department couldn't communicate to the fire department to say that those buildings are coming down. I do have a question for the fire chief. One of the issues with the 800 megahertz, maybe it's the old system, was we were having difficulty, or other agencies were having difficulty communicating outside of certain buildings. The system seemed to work very well for the police department, and we had some issues in the fire department. Could you talk about some of those issues and how this 7X system's going to resolve it?
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Summers, the 7X platform system in itself does not solve that issue. That's an issue of radio coverage and in-building coverage. Fire departments versus the police department have a higher level of priority for in-building coverage. And it's based on the ability of the frequency. 800 megahertz is a better penetrating frequency than what we're operating before on VHF. The tower siding and the infrastructure is now better than our old system. So in Mesa, we don't have a huge problem with in-building coverage. We have some challenges with that. Phoenix has got a greater problem with in-building coverage because of the downtown high-rise corridor and a few other issues that they need to resolve. There is some additional resolution to the in-building coverage issue, and that's with, hopefully, with mobile repeaters. And that'll hopefully solve the problem for Phoenix, so Phoenix can feel comfortable coming onto the system. And then Mike Brown may have some additional technical thoughts on that, but I don't believe 7X resolves the in-building coverage problems. It gets our platform up to where we can all operate together consistently.
Yes, that's correct, Gary. Mike Brown with Communications. What this 7X platform will do, it is an enhancement to the software that operates the system. Also, there will be some hardware advances. It'll also make it easier for the capacity of our dispatch consoles to increase, especially with Mesa. We've now reached the point where we would have to enhance our system to increase the ability to add dispatch consoles. Also, it'll once we do bring on the newer consoles, it'll circumvent some of the equipment that we now use, and it'll be IP based. We'll be able to make direct connects to the system with the consoles themselves.
So does this cost then reflect all of those changes, the necessary changes in infrastructure, I mean, radio purchases, those types of things? Is this it, or is this just for the software?
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Summers, this cost that we are asking today reflects just the upgrade to 7X. It covers the implementation of 7X. There are no additional costs beyond this to put 7X into service for Mesa and Phoenix.
But to utilize this 800 megahertz, we would have to buy more radios, new radios. We're good with that.
That's correct.
Sure. All right, that's it for now.
Okay. Tom?
The last several council meetings, including the one Monday night, we're spending a lot of grant money for everything from things that are on Monday night's agenda. And I'm assuming the federal government's not going to turn off the spigot, so we're going to get more grants for security, Homeland Security, in the years ahead. Can we use any of those to help cover this $465,000 shortfall?
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Rawls, I'm not sure we can, because we can't identify those funds going out into the future. And as we've seen the trend the last couple of years, our Homeland Security dollars have been dwindling. The war effort has certainly taken away a lot of the money that's been pumped back into the homeland. So we can't actually predict how much money is going to be put into homeland next year.
No, I know we can't predict, and I know we can't commit it, but we don't need to pay it for 2 years. Can we, in next year, when whatever Homeland Security money comes in, are we going to be precluded from saying we'd like to apply for $200,000 of that to help us cover the additional money necessary to purchase this 7X platform?
Councilmember Rawls, I don't know the exact answer to that. What I can say is that we are going to, if approved, enter into this agreement with a down payment this year, and Phoenix will make payments in 07, and we will do the final payment in 08. So the process will be paid for as it goes along, as it's implemented.
I understand that. I'm just trying to suggest that we not preclude ourselves from applying for grants to pay the additional $460,000.
Mayor and Councilman, absolutely.
Okay.
Between now and November 2008, or when our payments due, if we're going to look for every grant that may be available, whether it's UASI or
whatever
else that we could use, certainly we want to do that. In addition, we have some other partners that are included in that $450,000,
right,
or $65,000, that we will also be talking to about their responsibilities in this program. Right. So we're hoping by the time we get to November 2008 that we'll be able to significantly reduce this down.
Right. I'm just trying to reduce the amount.
Absolutely.
That has to come out of the general fund.
Absolutely.
And if there's a
we
combination
agree.
Of additional grants, let's pursue it.
We agree.
Okay.
Good. Any other questions on the upgrade? You've got a great system in place. It seems like it's a kind of a no-brainer to not do the upgrades and have the capacity. So I appreciate the update, and let's move forward with it.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
All right. Item 4 is here a presentation on the Falcon Field sub-area plan.
Thank you.
coming the other way.
Good morning, Mayor and Council members. This morning we are in front of you to talk about Falcon Field sub-area plan. It went to PNZ. We got recommendation for approval, and in front of you we're doing a presentation. Basically the presentation is on your screen, and you guys probably got the color copy of the slides. There are just 14 slides, and also a color copy of the plan. And obviously it's a 60-page plan, and I cannot do the presentation 60 pages. So we kind of like did brief outline here on your screen, as you could see. Like, we'll be talking about history, planning process, plan hierarchy, Falcon Field sub-area plan, design direction, and implementation. Before I go into the plan, I want to introduce the team that really worked hard on the sub-area plan. On my left is Sean Murray, Planning Division, and Corey Whitaker, Planning Division. And of course, with the good direction and support from John Wesley, Planning Director. The history of Falcon Field is very interesting. It's like 1940, Churchill and the British were really struggling for two things. They didn't have enough trained pilot, they didn't have enough airfield to train them. So they looked at us, and we offered 7 airfields, and Falcon Field was one of them. And at that time, Falcon Field was 7 miles away from city limit, so it wasn't even within the city. So I think like 1,500 pilots were trained when Falcon Field was in operation. And then when the war ended, we got the Falcon Field Airport for $1. And then, of course, over subsequent years, it got annexed and got into the city of Mesa. So after 65 years, Falcon Field is not only just a training facility, it's more than that. It's an economic hub. The airport itself is one of the 10 top airports in the USA on the general aviation side. And it's the third economic-based airport in the state of Arizona after Falcon Field and Tucson International Airport. It's roughly the sub-area plan as identified in the general plan, and as you can see in this city map, the red area is basically roughly eight square mile, 5,000 acres, a little more than 5,000 acres, so almost comparable to GM property in the Williams Gateway area. This is just an orientation, so everybody can orient like, okay, this is that square mile is the airport. And then you have, of course, Boeing facility there. You have Walmart. You have our public safety training center, Red Mountain Ranch. And on the north is the Gila River Indian community. So this is, and of course, the Red Mountain Freeway goes through it. The process we took is council directed us last year to work on the Falcon Field sub-area plan. And as a staff team, we selected a planning advisory committee. These are people representing business in that area, like businesses like Boeing, Heliponens, Semflex, Tango One Aviations, businesses like that. So these people met with us regularly. We act as a facilitator, technical advisor to them, and work through them many, many meetings. As you could see, we had 13 meetings. The first one was July 2005. The last one was October 2006. But it's not only that gave us the meeting. We also met with the community as a whole. Like, we had two big meetings in the community for getting their input. One was in the Longbow Golf Course Clubhouse. One was in the public facility safety building. And in those meetings, we obviously heard a lot of community input, and I believe in both the meetings, Councilmember Rex Griswold was present. Then, even after that, we sent property owners individual letters, the ones we thought is impacted by these plans. So we got comments from them, and then in November 16th, we went to PNZ. PNZ recommended approval, and we're in front of you. This is just an overall process. Right now, I want to say, like, where does the sub-area plan fit in? We all know where is our general plan. We all know what is zoning ordinance. We have a zoning ordinance book. Sub-area plan, once in a while, we do it. So a lot of the time, people get confused and say, where does this one fit? So this slide basically helps everybody to understand. You have the broadest policy, which is general plan, and you have the specific implementation tool, the zoning ordinance. Sub-area plan kind of fits in between because it's an area plan. You go in, focus on that area to work more detail on that area. In the sub-area plan area, basically there are significant landowners, vacant landowners, like there are three or four of them. Obviously, City of Mesa is one of them, State Trust Land, the green area here along the river and north of the freeway, and then tribal land. Believe it or not, a lot of people doesn't know that this is actually tribal land within our planning boundary, and then BLM land, the purple color. And then, of course, you have Boeing vacant land and citrus groves. City of Mesa owns them. This slide basically shows you the significance of zoning districts there. It's basically an industrial zoning district. You have basically two zoning districts, M1 and M2, limited industrial and general industrial, with very tiny little commercial zoning district for Walmart here, and the tribal land and the BLM land that we just saw is basically zoned R190 residential. Other than that, it's mostly an industrial zoned area. This is how the land use allocations or distributions came up after a lot of discussions, and I'll focus some of the areas. This is the area between Greenfield and Higley. Right now in our current general plan is Business Park. After a lot of discussions with Boeing and the other business representative, it seems like it would be better off if we propose those areas to be more general industrial. So the helicopter impact, which you could see in the graphics, this is kind of their path of the helicopters, Boeings coming in and out, which roughly follows Greenfield and Higley alignment. So that was the reason that this area turned into more industrial area, so with the idea that it doesn't impact the businesses or the facilities that will be built under the flight path. Another area is all these existing citrus grove along Greenfield, west side of Greenfield, that city owns, especially this one that we say PNZ recommended revisions. This triangular piece south of McKellops and west of Greenfield was proposed as a portion of it as community commercial, kind of mimicking Walmart on the other side, and Business Park also mimicking businesses on the other side of Greenfield. After a lot of discussions at the PNZ and also the homeowners who lives along the canal here did not like that idea. They wanted to keep it as open space the way it's currently shown in our general plan. So PNZ recommended with this revision, so that's what we're trying to show you here. The sub-area plan basically provides a statement of characters desired for this area, as in the general plan it says that it's a unique area. And this plan provides also a strategy for actions, how to achieve these visions, and architectural character policies for this area, which came out as a lot of discussions on an image building plan that helps the streetscape and things like that for this area. And of course, this plan also provides a land use plan to guide the future development. As a vision statement, it's an oasis of aviation-related businesses. It's an oasis of abundant, high-quality tech jobs. And it's an oasis of regional entertainment that attracts the presence of visitors, local and regional. And of course, it's an oasis of aesthetic beauty, possessing scenic vistas, quality architecture, and natural desert landscape. That's the vision of the plan. Part of the plan discussion, as I just said, the key element came out as an image building for this area, and part of that image building, architectural character policy was identified as one of the key policies to establish an architectural character for this area. And obviously part of that discussion also came that it should be a contemporary one. The sub-area identity, as we are saying here, Falcon Field area shall reflect a contemporary structure, idea. Part of that, we created a document and we put it at the end of the plan. You have this plan, the last 26 pages, which is basically, we're calling it as a design direction document. And the whole purpose of this document, design direction document, is basically to inspire designers, not to say, okay, go ahead, copy page 4 for your building. But at the same time, to establish a character, architectural character for this area that can uniquely be separate from the rest of the city. And these are some of the examples. In the plan, we have a lot more examples. Like one example here on the bottom left is, it's an hangar in Scottsdale Airport, aviation theme. I mean, as literal as theme like this airplane that everybody as a kid, I'm sure, did it. This one is our terminal in Williamsfield Airport. This one also Falcon Field. And you can see as simple as this one is Williamsfield, where somebody got inspired and did those two exhaust fans turn into a plane. So we're not talking about you need millions of dollars to do a character in your area. We're talking about your interest, your inspirations, and the theme that goes with the area. These are, again, some of the examples of very contemporary buildings, and not necessarily all big buildings. And like this one, a lot of you probably have seen at ASU Foundation Building, the recent building that got built on University. These are some doctor's office. This is even as small as this one on the right-hand top one. It's just a ballet dance floor, very little, hardly a 2,000 square feet building in Chandler. So these are basically examples saying that you don't have to be a big scale to do these things. This is another example of very standard building materials. We're not talking about any fiber optic or high-end or any material. It's all steel, but how you use it. These are examples. Like this building on the left-hand corner, if you take this red frame out, nobody probably will look at that building. But with that red frame in and the frame, it adds, it accentuates, it attracts you, and it gives a character to that building and also, of course, to that area. Of course, we have to talk about implementation. So we have land use designations that we proposed, and we have to find out whether it's an amendment to the general plan or whether it will come as the individual landowners are ready to build it. Zoning district, one thing we made it clear to communities and everybody that this plan does not change your current zoning district. And there was a huge discussion about the streetscape, that we have to take the lead to do something on the streetscapes in that area to create an identity. And of course, all of this probably will depend also on individual development as people are interested in coming in to develop. I just want to, at this point, thank the Planning Advisory Committee. They met with us, spent hours and hours discussing with us, and all the other staff members that helped us to do this plan. Thank you.
Okay, the action that is being requested, this is a here presentation on Falcon Field sub-area plan. There looked like there were some architectural stuff and some possible land use changes that may be coming about. What information do you need from the council this morning? Just the presentation update, or are you looking for direction?
Items on the council agenda for Monday. So we just want to have an opportunity to give a briefing.
All right, the adoption on Monday would also do some type of architectural standards, or how is that?
Mayor, council, let me jump in on a couple of those items, and I'll start with that one. The adoption of the sub-area plan does include with it the design directions that are attached. When those are adopted, all they do is become a guidance document to future architects working in the area to help them look at the basic direction we'd like to see the area go. It doesn't set any specific standards, doesn't require them to do anything. We just hope it inspires them to help us create and move towards the vision of the area of really making it a unique and special area in Mesa that's of high quality and attracts the type of employment we'd like to see.
Okay, but if I take that a step further, once that's adopted by the council and design review looks at it and said, you didn't do it, so I'm denying your request. So I'm trying to figure out what's the balance between suggested, take a look, and it's going to get denied.
Right. Mayor, we've tried to be very careful in all the wording that goes into it to make it clear that it is just meant to be an inspiration piece to try to move people in thinking that direction. We've discussed this already with the Design Review Board, and they understand that concept of what it's meant to be. The intent is not to take it to the Design Review Board and say they're not doing this, because there's nothing in there. As Waheed said, we don't want you to turn to this page and do that thing. We just want you to just begin to inspire the developers in the area to move in a contemporary theme that expresses a high quality for the area.
Okay, because I'm sure we could have some discussions about whether the red pylons out in front of the building are an incompleted building or whether it adds to the architectural appearance of the building. So I'm not sure I want to go there, but Tom?
Mayor, on that subject, I'm a little troubled by the language that appears on page 7 of the report. It says staff will keep the design direction document updated with the most appropriate examples of latest buildings, form, materials, etc. So we're going to be approving a document that has design directions that staff is then going to have the opportunity to adjust and add to after we approve it. So we're essentially giving staff carte blanche to add to the document that carries with it our approval. I feel very uncomfortable with that procedure. And secondly, the sentence above that talks about the fact that the design direction document is created not for copying, but to establish a level of design quality. That's not inspirational. You're setting a design quality standard that if you don't meet it, you're not going to get approved, because the next three subparagraphs all talk about shall. So I'm very concerned about this whole design direction portion of this plan.
Councilmember Griswold.
I have some similar concerns, but basically what it's saying is don't build flat, long steel hangers with pressed metal. Do something interesting. The Himmervitz down at Williams Gateway taking the duct fans coming out and just putting two wings on the other side made a very flat building into something that's pretty neat. My concern is design review is used to doing the citywide. On an airport, there's form and function. You know, it's great to make something look good, but the tail of your jet cannot get into the hangar, it's not any good, which one building down there was built like that. I would almost say, rather than design review looking over this area, I'd rather have the airport manager and staff, and that was discussed back and forth, be in charge of design. You know, they're not going to build an ugly airport, they want to have it done. It is a very interesting way, designing huge buildings and making them look decent, but also functional. And I'm not sure design review that normally does this every day, we've already had a problem on a 14-acre site with major tenants in there. Design review just turned it down because, and I've looked at the plans, they've incorporated a lot of good things into there. So, subjective is a tough thing. I think in this area, particularly in the airport itself, I personally would like to recommend that, you know, the airport manager and staff approves design criteria. If you're trying to build cheap and ugly, maybe that's not the right place to do it. Go down to Eloy. If you're trying to build, you know, it doesn't have to be expensive, but something that looks good, I think that's something good for the city. And shells and have to, the pictures in the back are just something saying, don't make it look like a World War II Quonset hut. Do something different. We're not going to tell you what it is. The trouble is, when you go for approval, though, everybody has a different idea of what, you know, is the newest and greatest or latest or whatever it is. So I would, in this case, trust staff on the airport to get something major industrial tenants there and something that looks good, but also helps the economic engine of Mesa.
Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. I think design review is a matter of charter. So I don't know how that would work, but I'm not sure that I'm looking at this and thinking that the issue might be in the wording. When it says design direction means thou shalt do this. So I'm wondering if I think we did this somewhat with some of the things in the Lehigh subarea plan. We took some of the things out of the document that the council was adopting and put them in a different form and said, you know, these are things that you might want to look at. Rather than saying design direction, including it in the document, having us vote on it, saying, you know, we're going to keep this updated, because some of this is ambiguous. I know what you mean today, but I also know that I look at things that somebody voted on 10 years ago, and I don't know what they meant when they said that, so I'm taking it straight at its word. And so what you're saying, I think, is we'll get some pictures of things that have been built around the area, including Dover Industrial Park. You're getting some good development out there. You're getting some nice design out there. And you're saying, well, we'll just update it with the latest nifty Keno things that are out there, and we'll show you. Sorry, shouldn't have said Keno. that was K-E-A-N. Anyway, that all those great things, and I think that the idea, the concept is good to have at your, when people come in here, look at some pictures of things that have been done well, to give you some inspiration. That's a good concept. The problem is when the council adopts it, it takes on a whole new weight. And a design review down the road is looking at that and saying, look, the council back in 2006, I can hear it. You know, people hold up that plan and they say they adopted this, and therefore thou shalt have to build this. So I think that if we can just work at that, is that something that we can do before Monday night to just
continue it?
So we can, or do you want to continue it, or what do you want to do?
Mayor, Vice Mayor, we can look at what wording modifications we can come up with between now and Monday. If we're not ready on Monday, there's no magic that says this has to be done on Monday. If it gets put off until January, that would be fine. It would certainly be easy on the pages that Councilmember Rawls pointed out to change the shalls to shoulds, for example. We can look at other things like that and see what responses we can have that might make you more comfortable with that. The other item that, Mayor, that you mentioned earlier that I wanted to come back to, too, is in terms of the land use plan. The changes being proposed here would not, at this point, actually change the general plan. That's going to have to be a separate step that we take to go through major or minor plan amendments, just like we would expect a private developer do to officially change the general plan map. Staff would plan to come back fairly soon with the city-owned properties and go ahead and formalize those changes so that they would be in place for our property. The question would be, do we go ahead and process changes for the private property? Staff's response to that would be no. We would let those property owners know that we've already let them know that these are being proposed. If it's approved, we'd let them know that it's approved, so at some point in the future when they're ready to make those changes this document's already been approved and set that in stage so they could take place.
Okay. Mayor, if I could, I think based on the comments, I think I've tried to work through this from the perspective of being inspirational. And I really think, based on some of the wording, it would probably be better to continue this or bring it back, because it seems to be a little bit more than just wordsmithing, I think. Probably, I don't even know what to call it, an addendum, a supplement, a reference for people to look at to give them inspiration, I think is a better way to look at it. And I think I had the same comments as to, if I'm looking at this, you're telling me what's contemporary, you're telling me what's thematic. How much of this are you telling me? And how much of it can I just say, thanks a lot, I appreciate it, here's my design. So I think we probably need to do a little bit more work on this and probably bring it back.
If we go back to page 5, which is IV3 under architectural character, it says that design review case applications shall be reviewed for consistency with section 1.4, which is the one that I was talking about earlier, and the appendix 1. I mean, you're really making appendix 1 part of the report, and having that adopted by council, I think, is problematic, but having it adopted by council subject to amendment by staff later makes it even more problematic. So I appreciate the fact that I think it's more than wordsmithing. I think it's conceptual. And I do have one other question. What is street furniture themed?
Benches.
We're gonna have benches with wings?
Tables.
IV9 down here on page 5 is just an interesting concept. Lighting hardware. Does that mean street lighting, or does that mean exterior lighting on the buildings, private property? What are we talking about there?
Mayor, Councilman Rawls, we're talking about the streetscape, or those things in the public right of way.
So we are talking about streetscape is 10. I'm on 9.
So I'm assuming they're different.
Street furniture. It's still talking about street furniture. Still talking about things
in
the right of way.
And the lighting hardware is the city's lights.
Correct.
Okay. Not as troubled by that.
Is there a feeling, the underlying one that I grabbed from this is some type of a modern aviation theme somehow incorporated into this? And I think that's a little bit what they've done out at Gateway. In fact, Hemovitz did such a good job of pulling that forward that it was kind of the standard to match and to maintain. And I think they're trying to grab a little of that same concept at Falcon, if I'm looking at this correctly. I support that idea. I'm just not sure quite how to put it in a document that still allows some flexibility for somebody to build a project or to bring a project forward with their concept in it without having to necessarily make it look like something that's in one of the pictures of it's already been built. So that's a tough one, and I'm not sure how you do that word-wise outside of here's some potential examples, but you're not restricted to those. And, you know, we could get into debates up here on not even liking the examples, which causes a little bit of a consternation, too.
Just as an option, asking, would you guys will be comfortable if the design direction part, whatever name we come up with, is not part of the document that you're adopting? It's a separate, standalone thing. Yes. So when somebody walks through our door, says, I'm from New York, I got to design this building, is anything happening here? Can you help us? What's the direction? So you give that document just as an example, so somebody don't have to drive the whole valley to see what's going on here, can see this.
No, I think that's appropriate.
Yeah.
Thank you. All right. Okay, any other comments on this one or direction? All right, sounds like we'll postpone this and try to do a reference on.
Thank you.
All right. Item number 5 is acknowledging receipt of the Economic Development Advisory Board. Two boards, actually 3 meetings. Have a motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. Your reports on meetings and or conferences attended. Anyone have any updates? Vice Mayor.
Thank you, Mayor. Last night I was invited to attend the Lehigh Community Improvement Association board meeting, and there was some discussion there about the South Canal Bank issue that's coming to the Transportation Committee on the 20th of December. Am I giving the right day? The 20th of December. Give me a time.
5:30 p.m.
5:30 p.m.
Lower
level. Now, I know there's been some concern. We are not trying to keep anybody from coming. We want everybody to attend. I know there's some concern about how close it is to Christmas. The concern we had was that if we held it right after Christmas, people would be out of town. We'll hold a second meeting if we need to. So if people can't make it to this one, no problem. We want to continue to take input. Just so you know, the Lehigh Board was absolutely unanimous that they don't want any lights along that pathway. They feel that it will change the character, the rural character of the Lehigh community, and so they were absolutely unanimous in that. So I think what we've picked up on that flavor in the community is consistent with what I was hearing from their board last night.
Okay. Attended the meeting of the National League of Cities in Reno. I guess that was last week. I have been selected as the vice chairman again of the finance committee, so we'll be looking at some of the national issues on that. I did bring back some there were free gifts around there. In case you're short on ink, I brought back some crayons. They happen to say Kino on them. Actually, that's where I got my campaign napkins, was the Kino napkins. But, all right. The conference was interesting. I was talking about ugly buildings. I thought their conference center was one of the ugliest conference center buildings I've ever seen. Drove up to it and they thought it was a warehouse. So hopefully we can do better out at Falcon Field than they did there. I probably didn't want to compete with the hotels, or there must have been something politically going on.
How do you really feel?
Yeah. Also, there are several members, mayors from other cities, Yuma, Tempe Vice, one of the council members, Gilbert, and Chandler that will now be on the Finance Committee. So Arizona's going to have quite a presence on that. And we'll see if we can make sure that tax deductibility of bonds and some of the other issues that are being substituted for a correction for the alternative minimum tax, and some of those issues do not negatively affect the municipality. So I was glad to stay on that committee. So that's my update. Anyone else? Yes, Rex.
I already mentioned last night we had the meeting on Stonebridge on the 720 acres on Ellsworth and McKellops. They're going to leave about 300 acres in open space and desert and high-end homes. I think that'll be very good for executive homes and attracting business to Falcon Field. Also, the a meeting yesterday on the opening of McKellops Road from east of Power, which should happen this month, and the closing of Brown east of Power, which should happen next month. And I was also last Friday at the DUI task force. We had our officers out there trying to keep people that are impaired out of our city, and they opened at 7. By 7:20, we had 12 people that were not passing sobriety tests already. So I was amazed at how early it starts this time of year.
Okay. Kyle?
Nash League of Cities, we had a very good meeting, my committee, for public safety and crime prevention. And I stress there again our need to pursue the immigration policy that NLC accepted on Saturday. And then my final meeting, well, not my final meeting, but for this year, our immigration task force meeting, we got together again. And I'll tell Vice Mayor Walters that Henry from CED was reported that he pushed very hard in the CED meeting the immigration issue, and we discussed it at great length on pushing NLC members to really get on the ball and push their congressional representatives that we need the reform and we don't want to wait any longer.
I forgot about a MAG meeting last night that we did get the 20-some million for the right-of-way purchase at for the Gateway Freeway that was approved by the MAG Regional Council last night. Tom?
I just wanted to ask Rex where he wants a subpoena sent for his testimony in the 12 DUI trials that are going to be coming up. Since you've made yourself a witness to those, I'm assuming you'd like to be called as a witness.
I just was told there was 12. There was one very interesting woman when in a long dress with an Adam's apple that I saw.
Vice Mayor, you want to weigh in after that?
Don't know quite what to say. Actually, I forgot to mention that I was in I was at Marlboro Mesa last Saturday. I got word that they were once again doing their annual toy drive, and their winter visitor from the North Pole arrived, and they have really done an amazing job down there in terms of that neighborhood and revitalizing it and people being connected to each other. So they needed a mention, so I looked at that and thought, oh, I forgot to say anything.
Okay. Scheduling and meetings and general information. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a reminder, following this study session and our executive session, there will be an Audit and Finance Committee meeting. Then Monday, December 18th, we'll have our study session and council meeting. Then we'll have, as the Vice Mayor mentioned, Wednesday, December 20th, is a Transportation Committee meeting at 5:30 p.m. here in the lower chamber. And then we do have our final meeting of this year will be Thursday, December 21st, which will be a study session at 7:30. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Do we have any requests to speak this morning?
We have none, Mayor.
Okay, then I'd like to adjourn the study session and call a special council meeting to order for the purposes of convening an executive session. And I have a motion and second to enter into an executive session. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? We're an executive.